The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Working these messages, most of them still only from the wartime period, until 1980, helped the United States understand the nature and procedures of Soviet espionage organizations, and also enabled the United States to discover the identity of Americans who were passing secrets to the Soviet Union. It was one of the most powerful counterintelligence tools that the United States had in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s.
I'm David Criss, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, January 27th, 2021. Today's podcast is the second in what I hope will be a series of deep dive historical inquiries. A few weeks ago, I sat down with the former lawyer and historian for GCHQ, the UK Signals Intelligence Agency, to talk about the history of British SIGINT. And today, I'm with Dave Hatch, the senior historian at the US National Security Agency. Dave and I discuss Project Venona, an incredibly significant intelligence program involving encrypted Soviet messages that began during World War II and went on for many years thereafter. It's a story full of unusual events and interesting lessons about intelligence and counterintelligence and spy versus spy. There's also a little review of encryption, and specifically the risks of reusing one-time encryption pads. Turns out there's a good reason that they call them one-time pads. The discussion also covers why we can talk about Project Venona at all. It's because NSA decided in the 1990s to declassify a lot of the material. Dave Hatch was involved in that declassification process and gives us the perspective of an intelligence community historian. It's the Lawfare Podcast, January 27th, Project Venona.
So Dave, welcome to the podcast. Would you please tell our listeners about yourself, your career at NSA, and your interest in history?
I've always been interested in history, starting from the time when it was just my grandfather's stories about the old days. I enjoyed history in the elementary grades when we were just learning basic facts. And by the time I got to high school and college and they turned us loose on original materials, it was like entry into paradise for me. I've worked at NSA since 1973. I've been an analyst. I've been a staff officer. And in 1990, I was in a special assignment that required me to rotate out. At that point, the NSA director had just created the Center for Cryptologic History. It fit with my academic interests, so I applied and was accepted. And the rest is history.
As it were. And you have a PhD in history, if I understand correctly. When did you get that in relation to your career at NSA?
Well, I received my PhD in 1985, and NSA had a program that helped me with tuition and the time to pursue this advanced degree. My degree is actually in the history of international relations, but I've done extensive work in American history as well.
Okay, so you actually got that degree while you were working on the line at NSA, and then 5 years later, put it to good use in working directly on history at NSA.
That's correct. I had started my PhD program before I came to NSA, but when the job offer came, I didn't think twice, bird in the hand, as the saying goes, and came to NSA, but never lost the desire to achieve the degree. And I'm quite grateful that I had the opportunity to do so.
So, Dave, was 1990 when NSA first created an official position for an historian, or does it actually precede that? When did they make a position for an official historian at NSA?
There's been a historian at NSA since shortly after the Second World War. Naturally, there was a desire not only to celebrate what had been done in contribution to the victory in World War II, but to learn the lessons of how the victory was achieved in cryptologic terms. The office was more or less inactive for a few years in the 50s and 60s. Intermittently, they had an historian. By the 1980s, they did have an historian in one organization, and they had a couple of artifact curators in another internal organization. So our then director, Admiral William Studeman, whose degree was in history, decided that why not consolidate this? And I don't think he would ever use the word synergy, but that's what he wanted, and that's what he got. He said, we can't afford to lose the important and hard-won lessons from the past. And he created the Center for Cryptologic History to create a culture of history at NSA, which helps us as NSA employees to understand our heritage and our identity, and also to learn not only great stories, but in the past, what worked, what didn't, and why.
Huh, so that's your interesting. In a book I know you probably read all of, I've read a little of, which is the 800-page authorized history of GCHQ, Behind the Enigma by John Ferris. He writes that one of the main purposes of doing the historical study of GCHQ was actually internal, for operational folks there to make sure they could retain the expertise, knowledge, and lessons of the past. So it wasn't just an outward-looking function. It was very much an inward-looking function. Sounds like NSA's approach to history is similarly focused internally as well as externally. Is that fair?
That's a fair statement, David. Certainly, we need to learn how to do our job and do it better. But there is a wider fallout from studying the history. It tells us who we are, what our heritage is. It provides role models for our employees. It has many interesting side effects other than just coldly analyzing operations.
Huh, that's really interesting. And I mean, certainly NSA's culture, in my experience, and actually that of a number of other outsiders who have been associated from time to time with the agency, you know, recognize a strong culture that is unique to NSA. I mean, every intelligence agency has its thing and its cultural hallmarks. CIA with sort of background in some of the Ivy League schools, and FBI's got its background. And I mean, one of the strongest things at NSA that I have seen in the culture, and again, others would say this too, is this very strong commitment to doing SIGINT and related activities under the rule of law and in keeping with legal requirements. Doesn't mean they always get it right, but it does mean, at least from my perception, that it's part of the culture. Is that your sense also as the historian? Have you seen continuity of that or other aspects of NSA's culture over the years?
Definitely so. I think every NSA employee recognizes the importance of what they do, that sometimes, in extreme cases, the life of the country might be at stake. In other cases, more frequently, individual lives may be at stake. And I think there's a commitment to doing the very best job they can because they know what the consequences are if they do or if they don't. But I think there is a parallel track that every NSA employee has been inculcated with, and that is the rule of law. It's not enough to do the job. It's the necessary to do the job right. So it will have legal and, if you will, moral validity.
All right. And I do want to give you a chance if you want to tell me and our listeners the weirdest thing that you've encountered in your many years as the NSA historian. It may be that you got a lot of weird things and you could tell me, but you'd have to kill me. But if there's anything that you can disclose, this is your chance to tell a funny story if you want to.
Every so often when there's a TV program, one of these mysteries behind history type programs that deals with a certain hidden treasure in Virginia for which there is supposedly encoded instructions on how to find it. Every time there's a program like that, or perhaps a prominent newspaper article, or perhaps even a podcast about this, I get multiple calls from people who say they know that NSA has solved the treasure code and they'd like to go halfies with us.
Oh my God.
We'll provide them with a solution. They'll take care of all the hard physical labor in digging it up and then arrange a split. All I can really say, because I'm naturally a very polite guy, is that I will pass their message on to higher authority.
To higher authority.
What I'd really like to say is that I'll get right on it as soon as I change the oil in my solid gold Cadillac. Sorry, guys, we already found it, but that's absolutely not true.
Oh, good for you. Yeah, you can tell them to put the tinfoil hats back on. I will cut you in for 60%, and we can arrange that as soon as we finish here.
I want that in writing.
Yeah. Right. Oh, smart. Very smart. I see you've done this before. All right. So our topic today is the Project Venona. Can you give us a quick summary of that? When did it start? When did it end? You know, what was it all about?
Venona had its beginnings in World War II. But they were merely early studies. It really flowered as a project a couple of years after World War II. It was the examination of what were originally believed to be Soviet diplomatic communications, but which turned out to be Soviet espionage communications. Working these messages, most of them still only from the wartime period, until 1980, helped the United States understand the nature and procedures of Soviet espionage organizations, and also enabled the United States to discover the identity of Americans who were passing secrets to the Soviet Union. It was one of the most powerful counterintelligence tools that the United States had in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s.
Wow. That's pretty cool. So before we get into the details of that, I mean, how did you learn about it and why did it grab your attention?
In the early days in the history program, we would get anecdotes or little bits of information that the United States had done this back in the 1940s and 50s, that they had solved these communications, that they had been put to good use. But in 1995, NSA made a decision to declassify all the decrypts from the Venona program and put together a committee to help make this a reality. I was part of that committee. So I went from having bits and pieces here and a few anecdotes to deep immersion into all the Venona messages, to the background of the program and related activities. So I got a pretty thorough education in the mid to late 90s.
Wow. Okay. So all in sort of looking at Venona as a whole, I mean, roughly how many Soviet messages were collected and how many of those, what percentage of those were successfully rendered into plain text?
Well, there were many thousands of Soviet messages sent from their posts in the United States between 1941 and, let's say, early 1946. Out of those, the United States was able to exploit only about 3,000, and some of those not in their entirety. But despite it being a very small percentage of the total number of communications, what was solved was really pure gold from a counterintelligence perspective.
So, I mean, you're the NSA historian. You've got a really wide aperture on various NSA collection programs, decryption programs, intelligence programs overall. Can you give us sort of a net-net assessment? How important do you think Venona was overall and as an intelligence matter? Sounds pretty important.
It sounds important because it was important. It was what we call compartmented. That is, it was a secret even from most NSA employees. Only those who actually worked on it were in on the secret. But from an important standpoint, it was immense. It was an insight into our adversary. An FBI agent who eventually was given access to this for investigations called it stepping into the front room of the enemy's house with the key. And I really think that's what it was.
Well, that's a very vivid image. So, I mean, it sounds like Venona began in a way before NSA was even a gleam in the eye of President Truman. I mean, if this is in a just immediately in or after World War II, how was it done? How was SIGINT done by the United States back in the olden days?
In the wartime period, if that's what you mean by the olden days in World War II.
I guess I'm dating myself.
Yes, it doesn't seem that old to me. But at any rate, the U.S. had listening posts around the world focused on our enemies in the Axis powers, Japan, Italy, Germany, and so on. But through various means, we also collected other messages from a few other nations, the Soviet Union being one of them. So the Soviet messages were not collected according to the usual method by NSA's predecessors. Let me tell you about that if you've got a moment.
Please.
At the beginning of World War II, the U.S. passed a censorship law. There was a great fear about foreign spies and foreign saboteurs. And among the provisions of the censorship law was that two copies of every telegram going overseas or coming into the United States from overseas would be given to the government. And this was done. If that telegram happened to be encrypted, one copy went to the Army's cryptologic service for possible cryptanalysis. During World War II, the Soviet Union did not have its own international communications, so it paid Western Union or some other common carrier to send its encrypted diplomatic telegrams to Moscow. So under the censorship laws, two copies of each of those telegrams was given to the U.S. government. They were encrypted, so one copy went to the Army codebreakers. So without troubling its normal collection or eavesdropping process to collect foreign material, NSA's predecessors got cabinets full of Soviet diplomatic communications. Many of the messages, as was later discovered, were actually from the Soviet espionage organizations.
Oh, my Lord. So talk about home field advantage for Team America there. And this is probably another podcast for a future date, but I take it that the program you just described is actually what morphed in the post-war period into Shamrock or some of the other more problematic collection programs. Have I got that basically right?
You have, but you ought to talk to somebody else about Shamrock. I'm not prepared to deal with that one yet.
No, I just, right. It's a detour, but it's an interesting thing, at least for nerds like me and others like us, to think about sort of how these wartime programs evolve. So back on Venona, though, I mean, who started it? Who launched it? Who were the key players that made it happen in the beginning?
The military intelligence organization levied a requirement on the Army's cryptologic, or that is, code-breaking organization. They wanted the code-breaking organization to look at these Soviet communications that had been inadvertently collected and try to find out the answers to a few key questions about Soviet diplomacy. These were presumed to be all diplomatic communications. Have to understand that during this period in World War II, the United States and the Soviet Union were allies against Nazi Germany. But the Soviet Union had a neutrality treaty with Japan, which was to run until 1945. As the United States began to anticipate having to launch an amphibious attack on the Japanese home islands, it was important to know whether the Soviets would join us in that attack, abrogating their neutrality treaty, or whether they intended just to stand by neutral. So, in response to General Carter Clark from Military Intelligence, several analysts at NSA's predecessor, the Army's Cryptologic Organization, began sorting the Soviet messages, performing some rudimentary statistical checks on the code system or cipher system that might have been used. But very quickly, they learned that this material had been ciphered in a way that could not be solved. The Soviets had used what is known in the profession as a one-time pad, and it could not be solved. So there was a brief look at it in wartime, and the project was put on ice. But after the war, as the United States Army was rebuilding its cryptologic service, many of the analysts for training and for understanding the state of the art of cryptology began looking at old messages. And when they took a harder look at these Soviet diplomatic messages, they noticed some statistical anomalies. Some portions of these messages did not have the statistical results that would be expected if they were really using a one-time pad to encrypt their messages. So a harder look was taken, and they found some portions of 3,000 messages that looked as if they might be vulnerable to various kinds of cryptanalysis. So a false start during World War Right. II, a much stronger effort starting from about 1947.
Wow. Okay, so that is every answer you give like triggers about 10 questions in me. Let me try to sort of go through because it's just an unbelievable onion to peel back here. So first of all, we are spying on our allies in World War II, the Soviets, if I understood you correctly, and we're doing that principally for sort of geopolitical and strategic insights around what presumably will come out of their diplomatic traffic. Did I pick that piece up correctly?
Yes, that is correct. But you have to realize the Soviets were spying on us too.
It goes around and comes around, right?
Absolutely right.
Okay. And then we're going to get into one-time pads and stuff like that. But at the time, NSA or the Army service basically says, I don't think we can break this, but they don't like throw away all those Western Union telegrams and other transmissions. They presumably store them. I don't know what the modality of the day was, whether it's paper, magnetic tape, or some other kind of retention mechanism, but they are keeping these things then for a relatively long period of time, even though they feel at the moment that they can't break through the enciphering. Is that right?
Yes, that is correct. They were very thrifty guys, I think. and the material was on paper.
Okay, great. So I can just imagine like battered, you know, metal file cabinets in some dusty corner of the basement of Fort Meade or whatever, or Camp Meade, I guess maybe it was at that time.
It was actually at Arlington Hall Station in Northern Virginia. Okay. And it was dangerous to be on the first floor because all these filing cabinets full of paper were on the second floor.
And they might just come down through the ceiling, huh? Is that it?
It looked in some places like it was about to.
Oh, my Lord. And it's funny because I just did a big, long paper on the new SIGINT annex that, you know, NSA released just last week or a couple weeks ago. And it's notable in there some of the retention periods that have been authorized for collected signals intelligence. And in some ways, the story of Venona is a nice illustration of how long-term retention, at least before exploitation of the communication is possible, can turn out to be really, really valuable, because here they took a swing and missed, stuck it in these heavy, heavy filing cabinets, creating risks of physical harm, but nonetheless were able to come back at it. And if I understood you correctly, they actually came back to these cables and other communications, not so much in hopes of exploiting them for intelligence value, but more as part of a cryptologic educational function?
Yes, that's correct. They were used to help analysts understand the nature of the various systems that they might face, and I think it provided them something to do in a period when we were not at war.
And so tell us a little bit, if you can, for a non-technical audience, you know, broadly speaking, I guess first, how and why it is that encrypted data isn't readable, and sort of how it gets enciphered using a one-time pad. And no math, please. No math, Dave. Okay?
I take my socks off to count above 10, so you're not going to get any math from me.
Okay, great.
But the Soviet process began with a code book. It's a code book is a list of words, and next to each word, there is a four-digit number that never changes in relation to that word. So when a message is to be sent, a code clerk will take the plain language Russian, go to the code book, and convert all the real words into the numbers that are beside that word in the code book. So they end up with a message full of four-digit groups of numbers. They next go to an encipherment table, or an additive table, they call it, which is just a list of randomly generated numbers. They add the codebook numbers to the additive table numbers in non-carrying addition. And the product of that addition is their encrypted message. That's the way the Japanese Army and the Japanese Navy encrypted their messages in World War II. And it's the way the Soviet diplomatic service and the Soviet espionage service encrypted their foreign communications after the war, or during and after the war. But the Soviets had a twist on this. They used to generate their random numbers what is known as a one-time pad. It's random numbers, but only two copies are printed. And once they've gone through numbers, they are never used again. When the page is done, it's taken off and burned, so that only the sender and the recipient see the page with the additive numbers. Nobody else will have a clue as to what they are. And if used correctly with true randomly generated numbers and only used one time in the 1940s, probably many years later, I'm not a cryptanalyst, so I can't say 100%, but at that time anyway, they were unsolvable. Wow. So why aren't we ending this podcast now?
Right.
Yeah, I anticipate your next question, but the answer is, the Soviets made a monumental blunder. I think there was probably, it's speculated that there was a commissar in the one-time pad factory who couldn't meet his quota because the factory probably had been evacuated ahead of the Nazi invasion and so on. And not making one's quota was a bad career move in Stalin's Soviet Union. So this guy was very clever. In a few cases, he printed the one-time pads twice. He distributed the pages cleverly, so no user ever realized he was repeating a page. But the American codebreakers discovered this had been done. The Army had always been a leader in analytic techniques based on statistics. Okay. And several of the brilliant mathematicians of that time came up with advanced statistical analytic methods to turn one page against its duplicate page and come up with what had been the code book number that never changes in relation to a word.
Okay, I see. So in the code book, you've got something like the word attack will be rendered as the number, I don't know, 4378. And then you've got this frosting on top of that cake from the one-time pad, which is today, Tuesday the 3rd of January, we're going to use an addition of 2186 on top of this, but without carrying if the number goes over 10. So it reminds me a little bit like of Tom Lehrer and New Math. But, you know, who, by the way, did have an association with NSA, or at least I've seen some of his unclassified papers in NSA's unclassified holdings.
Yes, he did his military service with the Army and NSA back in the early 1950s, I think.
Oh, my Lord. So I know him principally as a musical humorist, but I gather he's actually quite a good mathematician and still, I believe, teaches out on the West Coast in the California schools, I think, out there in the colleges. So
yes, yes. And many NSA people still enjoy his music. I know I do.
I do too. So it reminds me of the New Math song. But you take the code book number, you add it to the one-time pad, and then that combined number is the rendering of the word in question. And I can sort of see how if the one-time pads are really randomly generated, and if they're really used only one time, you know, you're basically kind of stuck as a cryptanalyst trying to figure out, you know, how the combined number is made up. But it's actually amazing to me that because of the pressure not to get shot for failing to meet industrial quotas and the use of a two-time pad, it literally allows the whiz kids at the Army to sort of unpack the whole thing and figure out what the code book baseline code is, which then I assume gives them a head start in trying to crack the use of any one-time pad on top of that.
Well, those whiz kids really were wizards. The next step in the process is what in the profession is called book breaking. That's a skill that goes back to the Renaissance, where once one has established what a particular four-digit number means, one plugs it into a model of the original code book and gradually over time reconstruct the code book.
And so I know you are an NSA guy and a SIGINTer, therefore, but was there anything else? It pains me even to say it, but is it possible that Humint contributed in any way to the book breaking, or was it a pure SIGINT enterprise?
It was purely SIGINT at the beginning. As the story progressed, there were some Humint inputs that helped the cryptanalysts understand what various numbers would mean. For example, in some of the messages, the Soviets quoted stolen documents from the U.S. And by obtaining copies of those documents, the codebreakers were therefore able to figure out what more of those four-digit groups meant, because they had had it down in black and white, literally.
Right. So they could actually reverse engineer from the plain text back through the ciphers, I guess.
That's correct.
Yeah. There's some public suggestion in the record, and you can feel free to sidestep this if it puts you in a strange position, but there's some reference to recovering some kind of half-burned or partially damaged code book as part of this. Is that something you can comment on? And if so, is that true? Did it help? How did it contribute?
Oh, yes, I can certainly comment on that. There was such a code book, but even though it was acquired during World War II, The U.S. Cryptologists didn't know it was in the inventory until well after Venona had been solved theoretically. The code book that was recovered was not the code book the KGB in the United States used anyway. It helped the codebreakers understand how a Soviet espionage code book was set up and helped recover some words here and there, but it was not the the key to everything. It was part of a trove of cryptologic materials the OSS, America's first covert action agency, had acquired from Finland. The Finns had acquired it during their nasty little war with the Soviet Union. A Soviet spy center at Petsamo, Finland, had been forced to evacuate. They burned their code books, but not completely. The Finns recovered one and put it with a number of material that they sold to the United States. But it lay on the shelves in the OSS warehouse, unbeknownst to the codebreakers until, I think, the early 1950s.
Huh. Man, this ought to be taught as like a case study in, like, you know, doing SIGINT for a diplomatic purpose on an ally during wartime that is deemed to be a failure, that is restarted then for teaching purposes primarily, that results in a breakthrough because some guy in some factory somewhere is trying to avoid, you know, getting shot for failing to produce enough material in keeping with Stalin's requirements. So he goes to two time pads. And then there's also a code book from a failed, you know, information destruction effort that might have been useful, but the dots aren't connected between the human collectors and the SIGINTers. And so they don't take advantage of it until after the fact. I mean, you can just imagine like some 9/11 commission style or other kind of inquiry into what worked well and what worked poorly here. But I guess that's what you're supplying for us, is just a case study in sort of how these kind of big operations play out. So,
well, what can I say? Serendipity happens.
Yeah, exactly. That's a polite way of putting it. Both on the you know, side of unexpected successes, and then on the side of kind of moments that in hindsight you think, wow, we might have saved ourselves some trouble. So let's talk about some of the insights that came out of Venona. What do you think were the most significant, and how did those things play out in practice?
I think that there were two benefits. One, long-term, in that it gave the Americans more insight into Soviet espionage operations in North America. Just as important was the revelation that dozens of Americans were passing secret or near-secret information to the Soviets. And the Venona messages helped the law enforcement authorities to track down many of those who were betraying their country's secrets.
So that's like the Manhattan Project spies and the Rosenbergs, Alger Hiss, those type of people?
You've mentioned the main ones, but yes, and there were many lesser known spies as well who were identified through this. Let me give you a little bit of background on how this came about.
Yeah, that'd be great.
The Army had solved these messages, and they realized that they had powerful material, but they were unable to use it themselves. Under a 19th century law called the Posse Comitatus Law, the military is prohibited from engaging in law enforcement activities. Now, catching spies certainly has strong national security implications, but it is also basically a law enforcement act. So, not able to use this material for investigative purposes, the military went to J. Edgar Hoover, head of the FBI, and they told him, "We have a powerful counterintelligence tool which we are willing to share with you, but there's a condition." The condition was this material from code breaking must never be made public and must not be used in prosecution of those who were investigated under it. Hoover agreed and kept his promise. The FBI used decrypts from the Venona Project as starter kits. There were a couple of FBI special agents who were cleared for it. They would visit Arlington Hall. They would get decrypts that dealt with Soviet espionage matters, and then they could tell their field agents, we've had a tip from a reliable source. You ought to be looking at such and such, or you ought to be investigating in this area. And then the FBI would develop its own chain of evidence that could be used in prosecuting the guilty or the accused.
Yeah, so that is a fascinating sort of precursor for some of the problems that, or issues, I should say, that arise, you know, even in much more recent days. They didn't at that time have the benefit of the Classified Information Procedures Act and the statutory mechanisms by which classified information can be used but still protected in criminal prosecutions. And they presumably didn't quite have the benefit of some of the modern case law interpreting the Posse Comitatus Act. And so it sounds like they engaged in what some people today would call parallel reconstruction. It would be fascinating someday to really dig into the sort of tip and lead function there. But let me just say, I mean, you know, these kinds of debates about using sources and methods or exposing them in criminal prosecution is, those debates resonate with folks at the National Security Division of DOJ and the intelligence community even now. And we saw some of that in more recent times with the FISA wall and so forth. So it would be really fun to try to unpack that. It's also good to know that Hoover kept his word, that Hoover kept his word, which was not something one could necessarily take for granted back then.
Well, it gave the FBI a lot of credit for being right on the spot. And I should say, remember that American SIGINT in the modern age only dates from 1930. So you have less than probably two decades of experience and no case law to go by when you're in that position, when they were deciding what to do with the material, how it could or could not be used.
Right.
And a lot of the decisions were made at very senior levels. And when I say senior levels, I mean General Omar Bradley, the chief of staff of the Army.
Okay, pretty senior there. Yeah. So it's not to be taken for granted, as I think it more or less would be today, that if SIGINT picks up evidence of a crime, that it would go over the wall or over the transom to the Bureau. That was a big, big decision taken not lightly back in those days.
Yes, I that's certainly true. I can't speak to today, but I know it was an issue that they discussed, they thought over, and made the decision that they thought was right based on the lights that they had, the experience, albeit limited, that they had had up to that time.
Yeah. And I mean, in all the movies, of course, you've got quote unquote NSA agents with badges and guns going out and rolling people up. I've seen that courtesy of Hollywood many, many times. But I guess in real life, that's really something that they hand over to the FBI. I won't ask you to comment on it, but but we can both. I will say that the Hollywood depiction of NSA is often a little off. It looks a lot more glamorous on the silver screen.
I would agree with that, except for the word little.
Okay. So one of the additional elements that's sort of related to encryption here is that sort of, even if I've got this right, even if you could get to plain text, you know, and get everything in the clear off of these communications, they were not totally stupid, the Soviets, and they would use tradecraft. So they often, I think, would refer to people not by name, like, oh, today Ethel Rosenberg did such and such. Or Alger Hiss, you know, gave us this piece of data, but rather, you know, like asset number 37 did these things, or they would have sort of secret code names for these people. So it, in some cases, I think, and even to this day, there are, I gather, disputes about exactly, you know, who was asset 37 or asset 19 or whatever. Is that right? And so the Bureau would be given something, but they might have to figure out exactly who it is based on the characteristics of the of this numbered asset.
Yes, every agent, and in fact, even people who were not agents, who were just in diplomatic contact with them or being referred to, were given code names. Even President Roosevelt, who was certainly not a spy, was given a code name. the task of the FBI was to take the information about the person given in the messages and put a real name to the code name. For example, one of the first people they investigated was a DOJ employee named Judith Copeland. She had the code name Shima. But in her case, it was rather simple. And one of the messages, the Soviets say that she has just been promoted and transferred to a particular section where she will continue to provide information. So for the FBI, it was a simple method of just checking the promotion and transfer lists and discovering her real name.
Okay.
In other cases, they really had to work for it.
Right. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about the Brits for a moment. I mentioned the prior historical podcast I did with our friends at GCHQ. Did the British collect some of these Soviet cables as well, or was it really just us doing all the work?
It's a very sad story. The British had, during wartime, collected many of these messages, but they didn't keep them because they were considered not solvable. Why litter their filing cabinets with them? So unfortunately, all those messages were never available to the cryptanalysts in either country.
Oh, man. So on the upside, their ceilings were not in danger of caving in. On the downside, they didn't have any paper to look at later. Okay.
You always look on the sunny side, David.
Oh, yeah. I'm a natural optimist when it comes to this. But I think we did learn some things, and I guess the British did too, about the role of Kim Philby, the notorious British spy. Can you tell us a little bit about how he featured in Venona?
Yes, Philby was mentioned in Venona under a cover name. And unfortunately, the equation between the cover name and his real name was not made until later in the 1950s. So he had access to Venona. He tipped off the Soviets that their messages were being solved. And as he understood that the code breakers and the British authorities were closing in on a couple of British officials who were passing secrets to the Soviet Union, he was able to tip them off and allow them to escape to the Soviet Union before they could be apprehended.
Huh.
So his role was enormous, but unfortunately only discovered too late.
And when he tipped them off, did they stop using the Russians? Did the Soviets stop using Western Union and other U.S. carriers? Or, I mean, what did they do in response to this knowledge of our exploitation?
Well, this was after the war. I don't think they were using Western Union anymore. I think they had established their own networks.
Okay.
So it was a different kind of communications. All I can say is they reconsidered the strength of their crypto systems.
We've got to really enforce those one-time pad requirements. So today we've got, you know, a whole bunch of Russian intelligence agencies, the successors to the Soviet, the GRU, SVR, FSB, and others. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the key Russian agencies or Russian players during the Venona era?
Yes, the key players were the GRU, which is Soviet Military Intelligence, and a naval equivalent to the GRU. Before World War II, the GRU was the main agency for foreign spying in the Soviet Union. But after the Nazi invasion of the Soviet Union, the NKVD, which had been largely focused on rooting out internal dissidents in the Soviet Union, became the lead agency for foreign espionage. We know that agency best today by the initials KGB. Those were the three main players that Venona was concerned with.
I see. Okay. So you mentioned something earlier that I wanted to just circle back to, and that is how it is that you're able to do this podcast at all, because I know you strictly comply with, you know, classification requirements. Tell us a little bit more again about how Venona became declassified and how that decision was taken and what kinds of thinking, you know, and factors are weighed in a decision to open up something like this. I mean, it may have been Kim Philby and others made it easier for you, but just walk us through the process that led to Venona coming out as it did in the 90s, I guess you said.
Yes, it was declassified in 1995. There were many Freedom of Information Act requests about Venona messages. There had been an autobiography by one of the FBI agents who conducted the investigations on the basis of Venona. So people were interested. As senior officials in NSA and the CIA looked at the project, they realized the technology was outmoded. They wanted to be a little bit reticent about some of the cryptanalytic techniques, but the fact that we had done this was really no longer secret. We might as well make a good news story out of it. So a decision was made that we could decrypt all or release all the decrypted messages, that we could talk about how the messages were used, talk about how they were analyzed, but still a little bit of reticence about some of the actual cryptanalytic techniques. But I'd say about 90% of the Venona secret project was declassified and released, starting in 1995 and spread in stages over perhaps a year and a half.
And you were involved in that, right? You were, I take it, part of that process and maybe an advocate for disclosure, or is that wrong?
No, that is correct. I was on that committee. By that time, I was chief of the Center for Cryptologic History due to a convoluted series of retirements and reorganizations. I had become the chief, and they wanted to get the History Center fully involved in understanding Venona and being able to interpret it publicly. We had very capable historians, very eloquent historians. And so I was on the committee and bringing the History Center's resources into the public release. So it was an exciting time as we realized we were making history as well as revealing it.
Exactly. Yeah. And what about the messages that remain enciphered? Did you think, or has there ever been a thought, hey, let's just put them out there and crowdsource it? You know, there's a lot of big iron out in the world. Maybe some private citizens can pool their resources and take a crack at the crypto. Has that ever been done?
It has not been done. That's a matter between you and the Freedom of Information Act office.
Okay. Well, I will be sure to press my forehead against the brick wall of that problem in due course. I'd love to see whether, you know, even now you could get some interesting insights. They might not be operationally relevant, but, you know, as the computing technology becomes more powerful or something, or other sources come to light, maybe somebody could do it.
It would certainly help answer some historical questions about both individual actors and about many factors in the beginning of the Cold War itself.
Yeah,
I'd certainly like to see it too, but they don't ask my opinion on it anymore. That was back in 1995.
Well, I have recently become reacquainted with the old joke that NSA is the only government agency that really listens to you. So guys, General, you know, if you guys could see your way clear to release, consistent with need to protect sources and methods, it sounds like there would be an audience out there that could go to town. More generally, I mean, you know, that Venona was a, as you said, a process of doing history and sort of making history in the release of the information. A lot of what you write, Dave, I think, doesn't see the light of day for, you know, what, 20, 25 years or something like that. Is that true? And if so, is that a bit frustrating as an historian?
It is true, and it's not frustrating. It's glorious.
No peer review, is that it?
No peer review, but for an historian, I and my colleagues have an opportunity that very few historians have. We are dealing with material that no other historian has ever seen or written about before. So the size of the audience doesn't matter. We are accorded an immense privilege for historians in being able to work on this material at all.
You're the optimist. That's a very nice way of thinking about it. Well, for people in the audience who have been intrigued by this, and I hope that that's a lot of them because it's a very intriguing story, you know, and they want to, if they want to go deeper into this, Do you have some suggested sources for follow-up study? Is there a single authoritative account of Venona out there that's available, or what can they look at? What's available?
The NSA has issued a history with some editorial redactions just called Venona. It's a three-volume history written by a now-retired historian. That is pretty good. It's based on the original material itself and many interviews with participants in the Venona project. For further reading, the book by the FBI agent that I mentioned earlier, his name is Robert Lamphere. His book is The FBI-KGB War. I was told by no less than one of the important cryptanalysts on the Venona project not to believe Lamphere when he talks about how Venona was solved, but that he's spot on when he describes how the decrypts were used in investigations.
That would make sense.
Many of the code names in Venona that were not identified initially through analysis have been revealed in a couple of books about Soviet espionage by John Haynes and Harvey Clair. That's K-L-E-H-R. One is was an archivist at the National Archives, the other an historian at Emory University. They had the great good fortune to be able to get limited access to some Soviet archives. And from that, they were able to identify a number of the previously puzzling cover names that the Soviets used. So if our listeners want further information, I think they can't do better than those, okay. Although there are a lot of books out there about Venona. I would like to say that one of the interesting aspects to Venona, to me, is how readily Americans have taken to it. I often read newspaper editorials or I see a reference in books where they just mention the Venona Project and they expect their readers to know what it is. It's really been internalized into American historical culture. And I find that simply amazing and gratifying.
Yeah. Yeah. It must be terrific from a historical perspective. Well, look, Dave, thank you very much. This is Venona is a fascinating story and well told by you today. I hope very much that you will consider coming back in the future for another edition of the historical podcast series on the Lawfare podcast that I am trying to get up and running here. But I'm very grateful for what you've told us all today and appreciate your time in making us a little smarter about the past.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate the opportunity that you have given me. And I always enjoy talking with you, David. So please ask again.
All right, will do.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Please share the Lawfare Podcast and give us a 5-star review on iTunes. Go to thelawfarestore.com for brand new Lawfare pens, lanyards, t-shirts, and socks. The podcast is edited by Jen Patya Howell, and your audio engineer is Zachary Frank of Goat Rodeo. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thank you for listening.